to talk with me.
Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. Once again, I'm here. Once again, it's a warm, sunny day in upstate New York, and I'm looking out my giant bay window. It's really just a big chunk of glass. They said it was the biggest they could send to me without a lot of surcharges. And the reason for that glass is I can look out on the forest and at my three bird feeders hanging just a few feet from the glass and enjoy nature, be reminded of the splendor of nature, whether you believe it's just evolved all on its own or whether you think the hand of God was in it somehow. It's a miracle. I think nature is the biggest cure for human beings' ailments. I think a whole book could be written just on that theme, psychologically, spiritually, physically. Nature is the great healer. So welcome, welcome to the show. I don't usually tell you my guest immediately, but I'm going to, although I tell you right away. But then I have some other things to share with you. It's Robert Whitaker. Raise your hands if you know Bob Whitaker. I hope you do. Hi, Bob. Are you connected?
I am indeed, Peter. It's nice to be here.
Good. And you sound good and clear. Well, great. Folks, this has been an exciting couple of days for me. And maybe hopefully for some of the reform movement, what we're trying to achieve. Last night was part one of a two-part HBO documentary by Aaron Lee Carr, an excellent, relatively young director who's done a lot of crime films and other things. And I think she's very proud of this film. I didn't know what to expect of it. It's about Michelle Carter, the girl who supposedly texted her friend to death. And I was Michelle's expert and wrote an 8-part series that's on Madden America. Madden America, that wonderful creation of our guest today, Robert Whitaker. And you can get to it from my website, breggin.com. You can get to it through Madden America. This is an amazing story of Michelle, who was actually convicted of manslaughter for supposedly, see the film, I think they're going to deal with the supposedly telling her boyfriend to go back in a truck and die of carbon monoxide poisoning, which he had set up for himself. And part one was most amazing last night. At first I was worried. I haven't seen the previews. It starts out with the usual press, violent attacks on Michelle. Then gradually in the hour begins to chip away at it, raising issues, hearing me talk about her as this really beloved girl until she became physically ill, hearing others talk about it, hearing me talk about the plight of young girls in America, hearing me talk about historically how witches were young girls, actually often healing and loving young girls who read counter to the orthodoxy and threatened the males, probably threatened the males most of all with the possibility of revealing child abuse. And she really, with the help of some others, let me put in context, a broader context that I was surprised that she did. But then I started thinking toward the end, is she not going to get to psychiatric drugs because Michelle and the boy who killed himself, Conrad, were on antidepressants? And there's evidence that, at least for a time, made them very crazy, actually. And maybe I'll get to talk about that tonight on HBO for part two at 8 p.m. New York time. But I'm not sure. It's called, I just don't know. It's called I Love You, Now Die. And as we got to the end of that show, I thought, well, they've ending. They're just about ending. And, well, I hope they'll bring up drugs next time. They certainly gave me a chance to put this in a broader context, as well as some other people. And then, bleep, bang, boom, some sound or other in my brain, and I see myself on screen again. And I'm saying that this story is just not a simple issue. It's an American tragedy of two young people who loved each other, but they weren't star-crossed. They were drug-crossed. And that's the end of part one. So, folks, and now I've read some reviews. Pretty clear I'm going to be in part two talking about these issues. But more important, no, not more importantly, but very important, the director confronts the hypocrisy of the suicide boy's life, where they talk about how they loved him and took care of him, and it's all Michelle's fault. Michelle killed him. Because as you'll find out, it's a lot muddier than that. And you'll be shocked at the response, I think. I think I'm going to be shocked seeing it on film when Aaron Lee Carter, when the film confronts him on the issues that I think I first told her about, of the father's abuse of his son. So this is going to be an interesting evening for me. 8 p.m. I'll be watching. I hope you'll be watching. And let me welcome a man I have enormous respect for, Bob Whitaker. Bob has written a number of excellent books, some of the very best ever written in psychiatry. And in our field in general, he likes to remind us he's a journalist. I like to remind him he's writing really good science. He's a scientist. Scientist isn't somebody who gets paid by Eli Lilly to do rat experiments and then human experiments. A scientist is somebody who reviews scientific information. Some he may generate on his own. Rarely do any individuals generate any on their own. Einstein didn't generate hardly any, if any, scientific information or data on his own. He thought about the universe. He thought about information. He thought about these things and then came up with new and better ideas. And Robert Whitaker is a scientist. He's looked at information. He's put information together. He's written insightful books on the enormous overuse of psychiatric drugs and many other issues. Mad in America is a title of a very good book and the title of his website. Anatomy of an Epidemic, a very, very good book. And also written with Lisa Cosgrove, more recently, Psychiatry Under the Influence. So, Bob, welcome to the show. And folks, let me say the call-in number, if you want to call in, and again, it limits callers because I ask that you call about the subjects on the show. I think that's always best. And you can call in about anything. Let me remind you, the last Wednesday of the month, which is going to be July 31st, is open mic. Call in about anything then. And I'll be glad to answer questions. But here we have Bob Whitaker. So if you have any specific questions, but I suspect you're going to be so interested in what he has to say. Bob, you have any thoughts to begin with? You know, I wanted to hear you talk about yourself, which you almost never do, about your contributions and stuff. But any thoughts on what I'm talking about here?
Well, first of all, thank you for that very flattering introduction, Peter. That was more than generous, I have to say. When we're talking about coming on today, I think what is evolving in my own thinking on this is just the more you get involved with this, and you were talking about the Michelle Carter case, you realize how psychiatry completely changed our society, our thinking, our sense of selves, our sense of our minds, our sense of responsibility. So what I continually sort of grow into is the thought that psychiatry as an institution over the past 40 years gave us a certain story, a certain narrative. They said it was a scientific narrative. It wasn't. It was a marketing narrative, of course. But we organized our thinking around that narrative, and everywhere you look, you see a story of harm done, the public health burden of psychiatric disorders, how we treat our children, how we think about our children. And the Michelle Carter case in its own way arises from, part of that narrative, which, of course, the narrative is somehow that suicide can be preventable with psychiatric care, right? And yet we have with the Michelle Carter case, I know you have the story with the father and the whole, scapegoating of her is just horrific. But no one wants to, well, I guess you are, and maybe we're going to see it tonight, but just to look into the issue of what happened to these two kids on these drugs. Were they fully in response, fully in control of their own responses, their own thinking, their own emotions? Because the drugs, of course, are meant to change people. So I'm just reminded how profound I think this whole story is, in the way that psychiatry gave us a narrative, we responded to it as a society, we believed it was true, and now here we are in 2019, and as you know better than anyone, Peter, it's a false narrative, and we're struggling with the consequences of living with that false narrative.
Exactly. One of the things that I don't know, I don't know what I'm going to be seen talking about. I talked with Aaron Lee for a long time on film, so I don't know exactly what she's going to choose, Aaron Lee Carr. But let me tell you this little vignette. When these two first meet, they have like a few days together down in Florida. They only have 5 get-togethers totally. It's almost all on social media. And when they first meet and you read their communications, and I forget exactly what their ages were then. He's probably, 15 or 14, and she's a year younger at that point. And by the way, I have a wonderful 6-blog series. I don't know if I mentioned that. Yeah, I did, on Mad in America, and you can get it through Mad in America or my website. But it has all the facts and data in it. And they sound like children. They're teasing. They're saying, I love you. And they're cute. And then that breaks off, and we start with some later communications. Now they are texting. And I think the first one, Facebook. And Conrad tells her he's come out of a mental hospital. And they start to talk. And he's on Prozac. And she tells him that she's on Prozac too. And then without their realizing it at all, one of them brings up nightmares. Oh, I think maybe Michelle, she says, I've been having nightmares about the devil. And if you look at the literature, talk to people, horrible nightmares are one of the most common things on Prozac. She was on another drug later on, another antidepressant. And even devil nightmares, and she says, are mentioned in the literature, and she says, I dreamed about the devil. And he says to her, oh, I started seeing the devil in the hospital. And she says, really? And then this sweet boy begins to torment her, as he did. He was probably a really sweet boy, like his family says, even though some of them mistreated him. And they start talking about it. And she says, you know, when I wake up, I sometimes still see the devil. And he says, well, I just see the devil all the time. He said, you know, the devil connected us. And I'm going to kill myself, he says. And that begins the torment of him threatening to kill himself and her saying, please don't, please don't, please don't. Until a year or two later or so, she just breaks down. And for a short time says, look, if you need to die, let me help you. You're tormenting yourself. But, and then she gets edgy and angry, but only in the last week or so of his life. And you see just this terrible thing. You see this boy who was sweet and innocent tormenting her with threats of killing herself, warning her never to tell anybody. You see Michelle having nightmares and the devil, stuff that probably never occurred to her before going on the drugs. And this is so sad, Bob. That's about what I'll say about it. Let's see if that's covered on the show tonight, folks. I hope that's covered because it's so poignant. Bob, thank you for bringing it to a societal level. They have changed the way we think about life. They being really the pharmaceutical industry with cohorts in the medical industry, especially in psychiatry, but cohorts all over the world because they can buy them. They buy researchers. They buy everybody. I think they buy judges. I mean, I think they've just gotten away with all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, I honestly, Peter, think this is one of the most extraordinary stories of our time, and it's not really appreciated, I think, in terms of how comprehensive it is. I mean, because it did give us a different philosophy of being, right? And the philosophy of being was, well, first of all, the philosophy of being they sold us was you're supposed to be semi-content all the time, which is completely ridiculous if you have any sense of being alive. And then there's a second
Well put, Bob. Go ahead. Well put.
No, I mean, it's just the dumbest thing the idea of normalcy that is presented in the DSM has to be the most philosophically barren picture of humanity ever created. I mean, it's like people who haven't read religious books, haven't read the Bible, haven't read Shakespeare, haven't read novels. Because
haven't even watched soap operas.
Right. So that's the first thing. It gives us this barren philosophy of what it means to be alive. There's no understanding of that children, as they grow up, struggle with their minds. They struggle with their emotions. And if they're in boring schools, they get antsy and impatient and that sort of thing. But it's almost like, if you go to a school where they put you in a chair for 6 hours, the idea is you're supposed to sit there and pay attention the whole time, which is ludicrous. Peter, you began with your introduction about the beauty of nature and the healing properties of nature. Well, if you have schools that don't let kids get out and play and be in nature and explore nature and come to love nature, what exactly are you breeding and expecting? So my point is, to begin with, it's a philosophically barren way of thinking about children, about thinking about ourselves, thinking about what's normal, that sort of thing. And then the second part is, having given us that, they feed us a story that they can give us these drugs that will make everything's all okay, right? And we were all around, we're old enough when Prozac came to market, and they said they had drugs that could make you feel better than well, which has to be the most idiotic thing ever said. And, of course, you know the actual, better than anyone, really, the data that was generated by the Prozac trials. And, you know, people were going psychotic, they were having suicidal, homicidal urges. So what is the science actually told about people really struggling on those drugs? What did we hear? Oh, these drugs can make you feel better than ever. You still there, Peter?
Oh, God, yeah, I'm listening.
Oh, okay, I thought absolutely. I got a buzz. I was afraid you got. I thought you got. I got cut off. So
no, I'm actually sitting here deeply moved by what
great.
You're saying and trying to think of just more about it. Go ahead.
So anyway, so we have this false philosophy of being. Then we're given a false story of how to be sort of content all the time, and that's a fake story. And so you see, like, the philosophy becomes barren. The medical treatment becomes a marketing effort. The science becomes corrupted. Of course, we end up a corruption of the medical establishment that gets bought by the pharmaceutical companies and these thought leaders at academic medical schools that get paid to be consultants, advisors. We as a public we trust people at academic medical institutions to look at our interests. I'm talking about the public interest, public health interest, to serve our interests. And what you see in the past 40 years is, and this isn't totally unique to psychiatry, but you see academic psychiatrists, they betrayed that interest. They, because of the money flow and the guild interests, they covered up harms from these drugs. They exaggerated the benefits. and they told one of the most extraordinary lies, and I don't really think our society has completely come to grips with this. They told us that they had found, for example, that depression was due to low serotonin, this abnormality, this chemical messenger, and they could fix it, like insulin for diabetes. Now, they told us this, and it was both pharmaceutical companies and the American Psychiatric Association. At the same time, their own research was showing that that hypothesis that depression was due to low serotonin wasn't panning out. And even in as early as 1984, the NIMH said, we're not finding a serotonergic problem as the cause of depression. And I looked at their APA's own textbook, that's the American Psychiatric Association's own textbook in 1998, and they said, listen, that low serotonin theory of depression is dead. It didn't turn out to be true, and they even said in their own textbook, it was sort of a silly hypothesis to begin with because it always arose from understanding how the drugs acted on the brain, and that was actually not what was actually going on in depressed people. 2 years later, you can see this avalanche of information from APA presidents, in former, present, and future, about how we now know that depression is due to low serotonin. So here's really a question for you, Peter. How come a medical if cardiologists went around telling heart patients or patients, you have a hole in your heart, now have this surgery to fix it, and it wasn't true, we would think that was outrageous. That was, you know, just belied everything we expect from medical professionals. So how come it was okay for psychiatry for all these decades to tell us that we had low, you know, that chemical imbalances were the cause of ADHD or schizophrenia or depression, and that's why you needed drugs for lies? Why is that okay? And why today, since the chemical imbalance story has completely collapsed, why isn't there sort of more of a public reckoning asking, well, why were we betrayed this way for, you know, 35 years? And this goes, of course, Peter, as you know, parents, all of a sudden, they get a complaint from someone in school, and they say, hey, your kid's got ADHD, and you need to take these drugs. And the parent says, I don't want my kid to take these drugs. And then the response is, oh, your kid has this chemical imbalance, and it's negligence not to give him stimulants. I mean, that's an example of how the corruption, the fraud, the, you know, the lying about chemical imbalances affected parents trying to raise their kids. And, you know, and what do we get? We get kids put on stimulants. We get kids put on antidepressants. None of the literature shows that this benefits the kids, but we do it. And even worse, parents who resist, not even worse, but, and also parents who resist suddenly are being said to be medically negligent. That's an example. Just, you know, I'm sort of talking about how when you start creating a false narrative in society, and now you start having rules, regulations, you know, evidence-based practices, so-called evidence-based practices, medical practices, organized around that false story, it creeps into every, you know, corner of our lives and in negative ways. Anyway, this goes to, you know, when we started this conversation about my own evolving thinking, I just am constantly coming up to the fact that the story that was told, not only is it a false narrative, but it has harmed us in so many ways. And just to finish this little thought, that same story was increasingly told around the world. So I've traveled a lot. I've been in South America, all through Europe. And everywhere you go, people were told that, oh, yeah, we discovered that depression was due to chemical imbalances. Take your antidepressants. And now, as societies have organized themselves around that story, and they see suicide rates maybe climb, and they see the burden of depression climb, you see this resistance to it. And I think everyone sort of wakes up and says, good Lord, what happened? How did we believe this false story? And how do we create a real story, an honest story, one that is philosophically robust, one that is helpful, and one that isn't just a, you know, put living and psychological difficulties and emotional difficulties into this disease box. So it's we really need, as Thomas Kuhn would say, a fundamental paradigm shift in our thinking about this whole part of our lives.
Well, you did a very good job on bringing this whole cycle from, you know, the Eli Lilly Prozac and the planning and the marketing all the way around now to our children have ADHD and a parent can be put in jail for not giving a kid or lose, that's not what usually happens, lose control of their children, have their children taken away at times by refusing to give drugs for ADHD. I mean, how deeply it's infiltrated the society. I have a few thoughts on it. I wonder, this also brings me to something that's so much on my mind that my listeners are aware of, and that is, Bob, the latest thing now with this ADHD and the bizarreness of it all is the FDA, the device division, which I do believe, if there is a devil, that's where he lives. He starts at the device division of the FDA, who just recently approved ECT in response to my work and some other people's work, forcing a drug manufacturer to admit it caused brain damage and caused in some people, massive memory loss. So within days, the FDA just abruptly came out and said, we approve ECT for treatment-resistant depression. And now they have approved a TENS-like device. It's a electrical impulse device to put on the heads of children with so-called ADHD, which is not a disease. It's a bunch of behaviors, and mostly it's normal. Sometimes it's boring classes. Sometimes it's goodness knows what. It's just a bunch of behaviors that annoy teachers. They require attention from parents and teachers sometimes, a lot of times normal. And they have approved putting these electrodes on the heads of children all night long with sufficient energy going through the electrodes to infiltrate all of the front of the brain and limbic system, and to change the wave patterns of the brain waves, the EEG waves of the children. We're doing this to growing brains. That's how evil it has now gotten. And I've set up a new organization. It's sort of a subdivision of our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. It's one of our projects. And we set up an organization called SPAC, Stop the Psychiatric Abuse of Children, SPAC, question mark, S-P-A-C. And working with Michael Cornwall, who is directing the project, a wonderful psychologist from out in California. Because this is like the most extreme, horrible, bizarre form of intrusion into the life of a child. Even if the damn headset wasn't even doing anything, but it is doing, in addition to headaches and a few other things found in a mere four-week study with, Bob, 32 children, 4 weeks, no second group. They're evil there, and that's in that center over there at the FDA. So this is how bad it's gotten. We're going to now have, if somebody doesn't help stop, then join me and my other colleagues in this. You know, we're going to just see kids eventually walking around with these things on. Right now, it's just every night for months and months and years and years. And it's just awful. It's just an awful thing that's going on. But let me address the question of, because it's so complicated, and you're so good at also thinking about this, is psychiatry fundamentally different from medicine? Well, I used to emphasize the fundamental difference, and I still do. But now that I've been learning more and more about medicine in general and co-conferencing medical, psychiatric, nutritional conferences with Pam Popper, we could take an example out of these major surgeries that are done for blocked arteries in the heart. You know, where they go in there, they put stents in, they unblock arteries, they transplant veins or whatever. And these are massive surgeries. And meanwhile, there are doctors out there that are reversing cardiac disease with a very simple, not quirky, very simple diet. Basic vegetable, whole vegetable, low fat, no dairy diets. How we used to eat before we had villages and dairy and and that kind of stuff, and unlimited access to fat. So this occurs everywhere where there's money and power and prestige, and these heart surgeons have a lot of money, power, and prestige, and they bring in a huge amount of money to their institutions. But it's deeper with psychiatry, because at least the premise is correct in most of medicine, which is something is going on in the body that needs to be fixed, whereas nothing is going on in the body of psychiatric patients that needs to be fixed, other than if they have a bad diet, it's going to affect their general health and how they feel, but it's not a specific fixing of a specific aspect of the body. So the big problem with psychiatry is using that medical model, it begins to impose what are really philosophical, social issues, issues that I think are fundamentally about love and engaging life, and for me, engaging a spiritual viewpoint, for me, gratitude to be alive and thanking God or whatever power is up there for this incredible universe that we're in. And you know, respecting my patients, my clients as treasures and not as objects to be tinkered with, and people to be helped liberated rather than crushed with drugs and lobotomies and electrodes and so on. So I think it's the problem is that psychiatry has taken over for religion. And if you look at ADHD in particular, for example, I work with not many religious people. When they hear about ADHD, they say, that's a family problem. Maybe the kid's bored in school. Maybe he should be homeschooled, family decisions. Maybe he hasn't been taught discipline. Maybe his parents aren't spending enough time with them. Maybe there's a father or a mother deficit going on there. And I have these conversations, Bob, with the evangelical Christians. They see it right away. Because they see that how psychiatry is a materialistic philosophy substituting for what are fundamentally spiritual problems. I think that's why it becomes so dreadful. Any medical group, any medical guild, I love you using the terms for the trade unions like APA and AMA. Yeah? They're like the old-fashioned guilds. They're meant not to improve the quality of their work, but to keep other people from interfering with their work or doing their work. These are closed guilds.
Go ahead, sorry, Peter.
Yeah, but basically that. I mean, I think psychiatry functions as a kind of materialistic religion for the society which no longer has really substantive faiths to raise their children on, to grow up on, to believe in. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I you've covered a lot here.
Yes, I am.
You know, in that 5 minutes, there's a lot of issues here. You know, first of all, just, you know, psychiatry with its disease model, I don't call it a medical model, it's a disease model, right? If you really look at DSM-3, they're going to say, we're going to call, like, if you're not behaving in school, we're going to call that a disease. Or if you're depressed or anxious, we're going to call that a disease. So that's a disease model, right? And it's a
sure, I think it's both, but go ahead.
Yeah. My point is, that's like they're wandering in the wilderness, right? Because if you don't know the pathology of anything, right, but you're going to call it a disease anyway, I mean, you're going to start contextualizing these things in a way that doesn't make any sense. And this goes in terms of, I'm going to jump around here a little bit.
Jump around. I think it's a good time to jump around.
Also, then you switch to regular medicine, whatever we would want to call it, cardiology or physical medicine, et cetera. That also has such a root in disease, you know, in fixing diseases. And at least, as you say, often there is some pathology there or something wrong. But when you go to, like, say, a heart problem, as you say, maybe we should be thinking about, well, how do people stay well? Physically well. And I, by the way, I happen to believe that emotional wellness comes out of a lot of things, right? Physical
right.
well-being, getting out in nature, being socializing, I mean, getting sleep. It's a whole body thing.
Yeah. You must believe it comes out of traveling around the world and talking to millions of people.
Well, sometimes that's good. Sometimes it leads to sleep problems. But anyway, my point is, there is this commonality, I think, a little bit, even within the other parts of medicine. So you have psychiatry off in its own world.
Yeah.
That there's too much on, you know, fixing diseases or fixing the problem without, like, saying, well, how do we really have a healthy population, healthy individuals? And, of course, if you're a cardiologist and you've trained this, what are you trained to do? Operate or, you know, intervene. So we have all these doctors that really are paid to do interventions when people get, quote, diseases or, you know, those sort of physical ailments. And we don't have a societal system for helping people eat well, exercise, socialize. And I particularly...
Right, and raise their children and have loving family lives, because that's so key.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And just one thing, you said ADHD is a family problem. I hear you. I think it's a social problem, a societal problem.
Because, absolutely. Go ahead. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm glad you widened it, because it's not necessarily any problem at all, except society makes it one.
Exactly. So in terms of, like, how we're raising our kids, how we're thinking about our kids, our expectations for our kids, the stresses we put on our kids, all those sort of things, and what sort of schools we create, whether we create chances for them to be out in nature, chances just to play by themselves without parents telling them what to do all the time, all those things. So what I see as, you know, what is it, 10% of kids are getting diagnosed with ADHD these days? That's a sign that we're not raising our kids right, that we don't have a society for nurturing kids in a good way.
And that we're labeling kids who are normal. I think that we must never forget that. We're labeling kids who are normal.
Yeah. So you have both. In other words, you have this society that isn't raising kids in a healthy way, and then you're just basically taking kids that are, you know, quite normal and you know, building a market out of whatever difficulties they have. So, but Peter, what I'm trying to point out of what you said is here is, everything you said is, it requires a rethinking, right?
In our total rethinking, yes.
A total rethinking about how we raise our kids, how we keep it healthy, how we build a healthy society, what should be important to us, and we're talking, I know you do a lot of work with Pam Popper, you know, what sort of diet should we be eating, and how do we get to our table healthy foods, and so... This is the conversation I think we need to have, and we just need to have this unbelievably comprehensive environment. And you know, my own entry into this did come from a much narrower beginning point, gateway, which was, are the stories we're telling about psychiatric drugs true? Do they lead to better outcomes? And then from that entry into that sort of specific drug-related question, evidence-based question, you suddenly find yourself in these larger questions about how to organize a society and what makes people well and all these really profound questions.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the damage being done is so enormous. You know, you and I were emailing back and forth about the suicide rates and how many suicides are caused by these drugs, and I'm still puzzling over that. But it's, you know, it's probably in the tens of thousands every year. It's just enormous,
and that's just the start of it, Peter. As you know, the suicide numbers are just the canary in the mine. You know what I mean by that?
I'm not trying to downplay
the importance of it, but you know what? At many colleges today, something like 25% to 30% of entering freshmen enter with a diagnosis and a prescription. So think about this: 25, and this is even at quote some of the most selective colleges. So somehow we have a process that makes 25, one out of every four kids think that they're ill as they hit, you know, that something is wrong with them and that they need drugs by the time they're 18, 19. Think of that harm. And something like 50% sometimes at schools now will seek out psychiatric services. That is showing about how we're creating, a population, a young population that isn't resilient, is primed to think of that as something wrong with them, in some ways, lifelong drug users. And as you know, many people start out with a milder problem and end up with being diagnosed with bipolar or something more serious. So it's the extent of this is just astonishing. So you have the suicide numbers, the rise in bipolar, the crazy crap you're talking about putting electrodes on kids. You know, as you, and I'm really wandering here, Peter, but you know, as you were saying that story, it reminded me of how when lobotomy was introduced in the 40s, we heard how that was a miracle brain surgery, couldn't really damage people. And next thing you know, they were even given lobotomies now and then to children. And it's today we look back on that and say, how insane was that? And yet here we are somehow thinking that ECT is, or putting electrodes on kids' heads at night is a good idea. And by the way, and you know this, again, 100 times better than I, but I know 16-year-olds who are getting ECT, multiple, they treatment-resistant depression, and they'll get multiple, times with ECT. How insane is that? When we know it causes brain damage, we know it causes memory loss, why would you do this to a 16-year-old?
I recently intervened in a case. I got a call from a Connecticut, similar to a kind of a public defender, but a mental health defender group within the state. Not welcome in the state, but it's within the state. A 24-year-old getting electroshock against his will and begging for it to stop. And fortunately, I was going to testify on the phone, and they argued for 3 hours. And when it became obvious I was going to be able to testify on the phone, the state completely withdrew. So there you go. The electroshock threat works, I guess. I don't know. I'd hardly know how to think about this stuff. But, the state withdrew because I was going to be allowed to testify. They'll do anything to cover up the truth. Keep me out of court. Keep your books from, getting circulated, keeping them getting published, I imagine. I mean, we all go through that. It's just, do you want to talk at all, Bob, about the, and you may not want to, about the suppression of your work in terms of difficulty getting published or anything like that? Or is that, because I know people think I get published at the drop of a hat. No, I have to do double work time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, from my own personal experience is a little different. Books I had no trouble getting published, Mad in America and Anatomy. And
well, I'm thinking honestly, about since then, because then you became a force to be reckoned with, a real force to be reckoned with. Has it gotten harder for you after that?
Which one? Say this, Peter. I missed that. I'm sorry.
Well, those two books were forces to be reckoned with, and once you did that, then they would have gathered their wits together about how to keep you from getting published.
Yeah, I will say
we don't have to talk about it, though.
No, I would just say this. There were a lot of attacks on me, and suddenly I was someone who was cited as he used to be a good journalist, and and there were plenty of personal attacks. And I will say, I got frozen out from doing magazine work on this topic.
Yeah.
You won't see me quoted in the New York Times. New York Times reporters might call us and ask for information, but you'll never see Mad in America quoted or me quoted. So you get expelled, so to speak. You're not really welcome into polite company.
If you're all effective, folks, this is what happens. Very, very important to understand this. And that's one way the fake narrative continues, as Bob calls it, that fake narrative, the false history, false science, false everything. And the truth just gets enormously suppressed by some of the wealthiest corporations in the world. Certainly, you put together all of the companies that are affiliated with making psychoactive chemicals, and it's probably the most powerful block in the universe right now. And they are very effective. By the way, I'm amazed, folks, that this film, I don't know what, the HBO film, if you're just tuning in, it was on last night at 8 p.m. It'll be on again on HBO. It's a two-night series called I Love You, Now Die. And I'm in it quite a bit, and I spent a lot of time with Erin Lee Carr when she was making the film, talking to her about it, as well, hours of filming too. And she's going to do quite a job at looking at the things we're talking about today. At least she did in the first segment. I got to talk about some of these broader issues in the first segment, but not about drugs. And there's a little hint at the end that I'm going to be talking about drugs in the next segment. So tonight at 8 p.m., it's the Michelle Carter story, the girl who, supposedly told her boyfriend to go kill himself. So, and got convicted of manslaughter. It's a very bizarre case. And that a part of that whole narrative, Bob, was to crush any bringing up of drugs. I got to talk about it a lot. The judge just said, nah, I'm not going to pay attention to that, basically. Nah. He wrote two reports with maybe 50 scientific articles cited. Nah, you know. No, he didn't even say that. He just dismissed it.
As you know, this has been a no-go land for a long time, public discussion of whether drugs could be contributing to mass killings, homicides, that sort of thing. I mean, you know, when we get these, you know, mass shootings, and then you find out, is there some psychiatric involvement? Were they on drugs? Are they suddenly coming off of drugs? You know, by and large, the media has not allowed that discussion to happen. So they've just said no, and the problem is people weren't on their meds, right? That's the only discussion that were allowed to really happen. So there are whole areas that the general media has put off limits.
Yeah, I'm seeing a very interesting phenomenon in terms of the reviews. You know, a number of media people have gotten to see both segments of with the show, that the second segment, 8 p.m. again on HBO tonight. But you can find it any time. After tonight, it's going to be readily available by all the streaming devices and so on. Although I suspect there'll be some sort of attempted crackdown on its distribution. But in the reviews, I've read a lot of them, and they pretty much like the show, and they talk about the controversy and how you're going to get a new view. None of the positive reviews mention that there's any drug issue or that I'm in there talking about drugs. It's most amazing. So even the people who liked it and praise it as excellent, they actually don't mention this stunning fact that, you know, it's going to be a psychiatrist talking about both kids were on psychiatric drugs. It's like, what are they afraid? They're ashamed. You're a journalist. What? How is it even possible that would happen with like the 10 reviews I looked at that were positive? There's one or two small reviews that are very negative, and they attack me. They're pretty. It's pretty junk stuff. They're not major like CNN or People or something like that. And they're positive, but there's no discussion of the drugs at all. Yeah, how does it happen?
This is really a good question. And I'm not totally sure.
I'm not totally sure either, folks.
But here's part of this. One is psychiatry was really in league with the pharmaceutical companies in the late 80s, early 1990s. We're really good about demonizing criticisms of the drugs. Anybody who dared to criticize the drugs. And that whole narrative. If you didn't believe in chemical imbalances, you were a flat earther or you were a Scientologist. So what happens is they managed to create in the media itself a belief in the narrative, a belief that it was a scientific narrative, and a belief that those who contested it had these weird biases. They were Scientologists, when they were flat earthers, they were non-scientific. So they literally managed to flip the script. I'm talking about the American Psychiatric Association in the thinking of the general media and the pharmaceutical companies, that the critics were the non-scientific people. They were the ones that were just out on a limb, sort of ideologists. And once that happened, and also if you did, as a journalist, start to feel yourself expelled from the tribe, seeing as something was wrong with you, you became afraid to go there, frankly. It wasn't good for your career. And, you know, once you... And then there's another thing, Peter, that I think we forget about. this model of care became so prevalent. Go into any newsroom. Go into any newsroom broadcast. You'll find people using the drugs or their kids on the drugs, right? That means they have to believe in the narrative, too. So beyond even suppression of information, what happened is they successfully created a narrative, and as part of that narrative, the critics were non-scientific, wild-eyed, biased people. And that still holds, and it makes journalists afraid to even think that. Not even write it, but to even think that. And I think that's what's happening. And I'll tell you, Peter, one quick story. My first real writing in any depth on psychiatry was when I did a series for the Boston Globe on abuses of psychiatric patients in research settings. But the foil for that series was conventional thinking that the drug fixed insulin for diabetes, and therefore if you did withdrawal studies of people with schizophrenia from antipsychotics, that was abusive, okay? Now, I got rewarded for that. I was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in public service, which is the grand prize in journalism. The minute I wrote Mad in America, I was ousted. People started looking at me, what happened to you? Because I broke with the narrative, and I'm just saying, I think that has a chilling effect that is profound. And that's why you do a series, you do the HBO thing, and no one wants to go with the drug to talk about the drugs in their reviews.
Yeah, it's amazing that she got it onto HBO. I mean, it's a very well done film. Watch it tonight, folks, 8 p.m., part two. I think that's really true. And then if you prove to be completely recalcitrant and you're in the medical profession, they try to destroy you. And we've had this happen now with somebody you and I both know well, Peter Goertzer, who was the founder, a co-founder of one of the more important scientific monitoring groups in the world, a huge group of scientists around the world in the Corcoran Corcoran Group, and now it's just called Corcoran, and they would endorse certain scientific articles and criticize others, very powerful. And Peter began to write about some things, casting scientific doubt on him. And then when he came across psychiatry in his more mature years, he ended up writing a book called Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. It's a great Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. He got thrown out of the organization he founded, which was international. Then he got thrown out of his Denmark Corcoran Institute that he founded all by himself, where he was professor and director and getting federal funding in Denmark. Got thrown out of that. Virtually, they truly uprooted him from every establishment connection he had. And, I mean, this is the kind of viciousness it takes to maintain this narrative, this false narrative about psychiatry and its medications.
Yeah, I think the Peter Goertzer story is so revealing. When Peter Goertzer became such a prominent critic, and even saying, "Listen, my conclusion. I've looked at the evidence. Is on the drugs do more harm than good." And he wrote about that. He wrote about suicides with antidepressants, and of course, he did from a scientific angle, because that's where his roots were, analyzing scientific data. And then, of course, he discovered that the narrative itself was false. It weren't chemical imbalances. So he begins this wholesale attack on the narrative, A to Z, and it's doing harm. Now, I never thought they would be able to kill Peter Goertzer. And when I say kill him, kill him professionally. For the very reason you said, he's a very well-received, he co-founded the Cochrane Collaboration. He's published I don't know how many articles in all the mainstream medical journals. He's published articles that actually did change thinking around the value of screening. I think it was for breast cancer. So he's got this history behind him. Yeah, mammograms of good science. And then he goes after psychiatry, and you see the moment that you're going to see that the profession and the medical profession actually as a whole, within the Cochrane Collaboration, is going to start pushing him away. And it's when he starts saying, you got, it's not just that you're doing something isn't right, but the profession itself, the way you're doing psychiatric treatments is doing more harm than good. And it's a lie. That's when you start to see the people saying, you know, at the head of the Cochrane Collaboration, Peter, you're going too far. You're not allowed to say that. And, you know, Peter, I think, understandably thought he could be protected from this. And then when you look at the excuse they gave him for kicking him out of the Cochrane Collaboration, it makes no sense. And I don't even know if the hospital gave any excuse whatsoever. So that is a really powerful warning signal.
Yeah.
Do not go too far.
But on a more positive note, in our last 3 or 4 minutes, listen to Bob Whitaker. He sounds full of life. They may have made it hard for him to go to the journalism parties, but he's thriving, going all over the world, doing wonderful things. They went after my medical license, and they didn't win. And they went on the basis of the narrative entirely, nothing to do with patients at all, just that I wasn't allowed to say what I had said on Oprah Winfrey. They went after my medical license in 85. And that's when Ginger decided she really was going to get involved in my work more, my wonderful life. She organized the media on our side, and we won, hands down. But it was scary and terrifying. But I have a great life. And there are a lot of people like me. My friend Pam Popper, listen to her on my radio show, The Nutritionist. They went after her, and she fought back and won. So I also want to say that what we're saying is absolutely right. When you stand up against such a powerful narrative, such a powerful system, they will exclude you in any way they can. But it's still a big world, especially for those of us who live in America. It's still a big world, and you can live and you can thrive. And I have so many friends who are so-called marginalized, Bob, you know, who are outside the system, and they're thriving. And so is Peter Goetze. He's doing great. He, you know, I worked with him. He set up his own organization. He's doing good.
Yeah, can I just add one thing here?
Is that fair?
Personally, can I say one thing real quickly?
Sure. Get it in.
Yeah. My own opinion is, my own feeling is, becoming a critic or being in this position has been the most rewarding thing in my whole life. It's fantastic.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Now, one conversation we should come back and have, it's what narrative do we replace it with? Because I know that probably as a journalist and so on and so forth, you don't want to replace it necessarily with a spiritual model. So someday we'll get together on the air and we'll talk about, well, what other models are there? Because I eventually, even though I was the class agnostic in the 1950s, when that was pretty dangerous, McCarthy era, I'm in high school, being extremely progressive and extremely agnostic and making little girls cry, which I still regret when I would convince them there was no God, or at least that there were good arguments against it. So I've had been on my own spiritual journey, and I don't know, would you want to talk about a spiritual journey, Bob, or should we stay within these confines as we talk on the air?
Well, not today. I know, I think spiritual journeys are important. Whether I've been on one is a different sort of thing. But also about what paradigm should replace it would be a great idea. So I'd love to hear.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, we'll have Bob on very soon again if he's willing. And God bless all of you. There, I've said it. God bless all of you. And thank you, my wonderful audience, for giving me the opportunity to bring great people like Bob Whitaker into an open conversation with me that you can share. Bye-bye now. Bye-bye.